Many of you will know that my home is quite male-dominated, with three little boys, actually getting bigger boys now by the day. My teenager is about the same height as me now. Don't know where that's going to end up. But my poor wife has to put up with an awful lot of sport in our home as a result. But just occasionally, my wife feminizes the home, and she switches on a program called Say Yes to the Dress. I don't know if you've heard of that program, but Say Yes to the Dress is based in a wedding dress shop. And it focuses on all the different kinds of brides who come shopping for a wedding dress and the struggle to find the right dress. I pretend not to watch the program, but I do take a sneak peek occasionally. And what strikes you about these brides-to-be is that they often seem more interested in the perfect wedding dress than they do in the perfect marriage. Many of them are very clear about the exact design that they want for their wedding dress. And I have learned a whole new vocabulary about wedding dresses. You can have it mermaid style. You can have a sweetheart neckline. And the amount of times that a bride-to-be comes in and says, I want to look like a princess. And when these ladies find their perfect dress, they often, probably about 7 times out of 10 at least, they often just break down in tears. And many of them seem more emotional about the dress than they do about the marriage on their wedding day. And I think that reflects a growing trend in our culture to be more focused on putting on the great event than preparing yourself, preparing your character for a healthy marriage. And not surprisingly, the Bible is much more concerned about the marriage than it is about the event. Eve didn't need to worry about wedding dresses in her day. These verses in Genesis chapter 2 serve as a foundation for what a healthy marriage looks like. And these verses are so important that they are quoted again by both Jesus and the Apostle Paul in the New Testament. And they're worth our attention this morning because this institution of marriage is so vital in our day and in every day. And because there is such confusion about marriage and what it ought to look like in our generation. And these verses set out for us God's blueprint for a healthy marriage. God's blueprint for a healthy marriage. And God's blueprint is summed up in 4 key words that I want to share with you this morning. The first word is maturity. That's the first key word as a blueprint for God's plan for a healthy marriage. Maturity. Verse 24 begins, therefore a man will leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife. So this verse envisages a young man moving out from behind his parents' authority and provision and being ready to take on the responsibility of setting up his own home and looking after his own wife. And it takes a real maturity to be able to do that. To leave your father and mother was a radical thing to say to a Jew because, of course, honor your father and mother was part of the Ten Commandments. In fact, it was the bridge between the Godward commandments and the neighbor-based commandments. The first 4 commandments are all directed towards loving God. The last 5 commandments are directed towards loving your neighbor. And the bridge between the two was honoring your parents. Because your parents, in many ways, take the role of God to you when you're very young, before you take on independent life. So how do you know when you are ready to make that step, to move out from behind the provision of your parents? It takes real maturity. But that maturing process is being delayed in our generation, I think. I think there are many men today who are still children in adults' bodies, trying to avoid responsibility as much as possible. They have never really matured. You can have a top job in the city and be a respected professional without having matured or understood what it means to look after a wife and a family. And I feel like saying to a lot of young and not so young men today, get your head out of the clouds and start taking responsibility in your own home, which is your primary responsibility. That is the message of Genesis 2. The moment that you say, I do, you become responsible for another living soul. Their flourishing becomes your deepest desire. Their well-being becomes your passion. And so a husband has to get rid of selfishness and ego if he is to be a worthy husband. I'm still battling with that in my life. But that is the kind of maturity that makes for happy marriages. I don't get married first and foremost to make myself happy. I get married to make my spouse happy. And if we all approached marriage like that, we would never have had the devastation that has affected the oldest institution known to man. Broken marriages, broken families, broken children, often surrendered on the altar of happiness, the altar of self-fulfillment, of looking for others to please us, rather than looking to serve and to love. The Bible would say we need to grow up so that we are ready to leave our fathers and mothers, to leave dependency behind and take on responsibility so that we can devote ourselves to our wives or our husbands. Of course, what this verse is not suggesting is a Gretna Green kind of leaving your parents, a mini rebellion from your parents' influence, not at all. A mature Christian couple will seek to implement any good example that their parents have set for them in the family home they were brought up in. I would say in my own life, Liz and I have learned a lot about a good marriage from both sets of parents, whose marriages were very different, but both very good. Having family meal times together where we talk and share as family. Doing a family devotional at the end of dinner every day to put God at the center of family life and to show your children that God is at the center. Showing healthy discipline. Disciplining out of love and not out of anger. Looking back, I never once heard my father criticizing my mother, or my mother criticizing my father. Now, I'm sure they had their moments, but it was always kept behind closed doors. We have learned a lot from our parents, and we're very grateful. And a mature Christian couple will hold on to the best parts of their parents' marriage and discard the worst. Leaving your father and mother is not encouraging rebellion. It's when a young man or a young woman can say, I have learned now as much as I can about healthy marriage and about healthy parenting, and I am ready to go now. I am ready to set up home and take responsibility for my own family as if I was taking responsibility for my own self, because they are an extension of myself. So God's blueprint for marriage begins with maturity, moving from a dependent lifestyle to a responsible one. Secondly, God's blueprint for marriage involves security. So it involves maturity, and it also involves security. The verse reads, therefore a man will leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife. And the idea behind holding fast is literally sticking to his wife. It's like super glue. It is the idea of permanence in marriage, a permanence that breeds security. The Christian idea of marriage has always been that a man and a woman make promises to cling to each other for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. People still say that at the marriage altar. They just don't think about it or keep it. I'm not in this for as long as you please me, or for as long as you look attractive to me, or until I get bored and find a better version. I am committed to you when your desires clash with mine. I am committed to you when it's inconvenient. I'm committed to you when you're going through a bad time, when you're ill. I'm committed to you when I am away on business, or when the grass looks greener on the other side of the fence. I will stick with you even when non-Christian friends and society's influence are telling me not to, telling me, oh, you've had enough, go on and find some happiness. I'm committed to you when I hear of colleagues who have left their spouses in search of happiness. I'll be there for you. Every healthy marriage is founded on this kind of security. The main word for love used in the Bible is the term hesed in Hebrew, which means loyalty, faithfulness. And we mentioned last week the Old Testament book of Ruth, where that word is mentioned, hesed, more than any other book of the Bible. And Ruth says to Naomi, wherever you go, I will go. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. That is the biblical view of love, loyalty, and faithfulness, which are in short supply today. And loyalty and faithfulness clash with the fast-moving, live and let live, find happiness at all costs ethic of our culture. But love and faithfulness are the key to a healthy marriage. Proverbs says, let love and faithfulness never leave you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. The neck, of course, was the place where you wore accolades in the ancient world. Athletes wore garlands around their necks. And so this verse is saying, love and faithfulness are the chief accolades that we should be striving for in life. Not success, not money, not freedom, not sexual fulfillment, not even happiness. Love and faithfulness are the greatest virtues that a human being is capable of. And the married couples whose love grows and flourishes over time are the ones who are so confident of each other's fidelity that it breeds security in the whole home. But let's be clear about what Genesis is not calling us to here. It's not calling us to a kind of grim stoicism. You know, just hang in there is the phrase for a good Christian marriage. No. It is inviting us to experience the full depth of human love. But the only way to truly experience that love is when you focus exclusively on your partner throughout all the ups and downs of life's journey. I think it's fascinating when you read how the two lovers relate to each other in the Song of Solomon book, a book which is all about marital intimacy. In the Song of Solomon, the lover is always waxing lyrical about his beloved, often using some very strange ancient language. My love, your eyes are like doves. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep. That was meant to be an attractive image back then. Your neck is like the Tower of David. I mean, they talk about each other as if it's Brad Pitt talking about Angelina Jolie. Each lover sees the other as the perfect 10. I'm sure they weren't the perfect 10. But the lovers are so focused on each other that no one else comes close. And that is the kind of security of Christian marriage. I only have eyes for my beloved, and she knows that. He knows that. And when you think like that, when you build a marriage based on that, love grows, intimacy grows, joy grows, and you discover the beauty of marriage as God intended it to be. Someone once said, you don't love a woman because she is beautiful, but she is beautiful because you love her. A secure marriage leads to deepening love when the partners only have eyes for each other. And there is no clash between security and enjoyment. The one stems from the other. Now, of course, I know how many of us this morning have longed for this kind of security, but have experienced only heartache in our marriages. Genesis chapter 2 sets out the ideal, but life as we know it is far from the ideal, is it? And perhaps we ourselves, if we were totally honest, we look back with regret on how we acted in a past marriage, and we know now that we just cannot roll back the clock. But it's also important to know that God doesn't abandon us when our spouse does. You remember that famous story of God meeting with Hagar in the desert when Abraham had rejected her and Sarah had rejected her. In fact, Abraham and Sarah had used Hagar for their own benefit. They had cast her out. God met with her in the desert. There is grace for those who have been used in marriage, and there is grace for those who have messed up in marriage. Here, but for the grace of God, we all go today. And of course, the very word Genesis means new beginnings. But that should not take our eyes off God's ideal as laid out in these verses. Security has always been the bedrock of healthy marriages. So this passage is laying out God's blueprint for a healthy marriage. Number one, maturity. Number two, security. Number three, unity. Unity. It says, therefore, a man will leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And this phrase, becoming one flesh, is pointing particularly to sexual union. Now, we have belittled sex in our generation. We have turned it into something cheap and user-friendly. So much so that the average 14-year-old in this country, 14-year-old, bombarded by crude sexual images and pressure from the culture around, is already sexually active. 14, that's the average. And they cannot turn the clock back now. But the sexual act in Scripture is a much deeper, it's a richer, it's a mysterious and exclusive thing. And the Song of Solomon is the book, more than any other, that enters into the beautiful mystery of a sexual relationship. As one rabbi said, in the other wisdom books, you are in the holy place. But in the Song of Solomon, you enter the Holy of Holies. Another rabbi said, the sexual relationship is the only time that a man and a woman enter into a pre-fall state. The innocence and goodness of the Garden of Eden, where the man and woman were naked and they felt no shame. Our culture has covered sex with shame. So much so that it's really difficult for parents to talk to their kids about it. It's difficult to preach about it. But we have to talk about it because it's such a key part of marriage and it is a holy thing. God invented sex and sexuality. It is pure. It is a joyous expression of His love for us and His desire that we experience true human intimacy. The sexual act is a picture of the unique unity of a husband and wife. And when you understand sex from a biblical viewpoint, it becomes outrageous to envisage a sexual relationship outside of marriage. A husband becomes one with his wife. That's what the verse is teaching. They become one flesh. They become one person. In a very real sense. So much so that in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul has very straight words with men in the Corinthian church. This was a church where the men had become Christians from all kinds of immoral pagan backgrounds. And of course, Corinth was a port where women were available, let's put it that way, in the town regularly, and men went to them frequently. It's just considered part of society. And Paul tells these Christian men that when they visit a lady of the night, they become one with her. These men want a one-night stand with no strings attached. And yet it's so much more than that in heaven's eyes. And Paul says to these men bluntly, how could you? Your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. How can you become one with a woman you don't even know in a tawdry one-night stand? The sexual union means that two people become one, and once that has happened, they shall forever be one. Every sexual act leaves its mark. And I'm sorry for having to be so frank about this, but you have to in our generation. And of course, that's why the guilt is so hard to undo. Something profound happens when a couple become one flesh. Within the maturity and security of a healthy marriage, sex is a beautiful thing. The unity of a married couple in a bond of love. But do not mess with that sacred union. That's the repeated warning of the Song of Solomon. The Song of Solomon keeps on saying, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Love is as strong as death. It is as unyielding as the grave. Sexual passion, as we know, is not something that we can turn on and turn off like a switch. Don't light fires that you cannot put out. Let me say to young people especially, don't get involved in one-night stands or get in compromising situations with your girlfriend or your boyfriend who may never end up being your husband or your wife. There's actually no such thing as a one-night stand. That's the lie we have been told. A night of passion is just a bit of fun with no long-term consequences. That is dangerous nonsense. What you do with your body affects your mind, and it shapes you as a human being. Save yourself. Keep yourself pure for the man or the woman that God has for you. You were meant to share sexual union only with your spouse. And that teaching may seem old-fashioned and even laughed at today. It genuinely is laughed at today, in secondary schools in particular. But just look at the wreckage of society on the back of our so-called sexual freedom. Sexual freedom, which came in largely in what we call the swinging 60s, that has actually been our enslavement. And it leaves men and women dissatisfied, always seeking something more gratifying. A growing number are addicts of pornography. So much so that several states now in the United States, two more this week, have termed pornography a public health crisis. The iPhone generation will just massively increase that. Teenage pregnancy is commonplace with no father in sight. And we haven't mentioned the sexual confusion of our age, promiscuity just being the norm. I hate having to talk about this stuff, but how can I not if we're going to be relevant? There is the price that we have to pay for sexual freedom. And it's fascinating, again, actually, the book of Song of Solomon, which has so much truth to share on these issues. The Song of Solomon contrasts these two young, innocent, faithful lovers who only have eyes for each other. There's a contrast in that book between the two lovers and King Solomon. The king, who you remember, had a huge harem and could have any woman that he wanted. He had sexual freedom. But the king with his whole harem was never able to match the beautiful intimacy that the lovers had found, who kept themselves for each other. God is much wiser than you think he is. He's much more concerned for your happiness and your security than you realize he is. Don't set aside God's blueprint for marriage. Therefore, a man will leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So God's blueprint for marriage is built on maturity. It's built on security. It's built on unity. And finally, it's built on purity. Purity. Verse 25 says, "The man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." Now, this seems a very strange verse to us. But it is preparing us for the fall of man in chapter 3 and the entry of sin to the world. Adam and Eve at this pre-fall stage were perfectly innocent in their marriage relationship. They were open and free with each other, symbolized by their nakedness. There was nothing to hide from each other, no guilt or shame or cover-up. And you'll know from chapter 3 that the first evidence that they had fallen from their innocent state was that they felt shame and they tried to cover themselves with fig leaves. There is a real purity about God's design for marriage. A marriage that is built on maturity and security and unity will also have this healthy purity about it. No lies, no cover-ups, no having to guess your spouse's motives, no cynicism or trying to get the better of each other. That is the purity that marked the first marriage, but was quickly lost when sin came into the world. Can we get back to marriages that are absolutely open and honest with each other? That we see and we seek only the good in our spouse? How many marriages are strained because a wife is cynical about her husband, always criticizing him or bringing him down to his face and, worse still, to other people? Or a husband who cannot be trusted and an anxious wife is checking his emails and his text messages to see if he's hiding something. This is all too common. Or he's bullying her or intimidating her so that she feels wary of him. It's an absolute disgrace. The best marriages are open and honest. They are pure and motivated by the good of the loved one. Of course, many marriages start off that way with good intentions. But over the years, little by little, they just slip into cynicism. And let me just say, if you notice that in your marriage, and it can happen in any of our marriages, then be open with each other again. Talk about it. Speak highly of each other when you are together, and especially speak highly of each other when you're with other people. Look for the good in your spouse, and when you find the good, tell them about it. If you're looking for the good, you will find it. You will find the reason why you fell in love with that person in the first place. And let's face it, often we come home to each other after a busy day, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody, when we have been on our best behavior with everybody else. And then in our tiredness, we use our most careless words and get into unnecessary squabbles with the very one we love. Save your best for your spouse, your best motives, your best efforts, your best speaking, your best loving, your best moments. Get back to the purity that Adam and Eve enjoyed before a serpent crawled into the garden and spoiled it all. So God is calling us today in a very personal way to follow His marriage blueprint. God's blueprint demands maturity, learning how to take responsibility for your spouse's needs. It demands security, being faithful till death do you part. It demands unity, saving your sexual desires only for your spouse. And it demands purity, seeking your spouse's good with openness and honesty in everything. May God bless our homes. May He enrich our marriages. Where there has been brokenness in the past, may He pour His grace and His healing as only He can into our lives. Where a fresh start is needed, may God give us the courage to rebuild our lives on His truth. For the blessing of our homes and our children and grandchildren, and ultimately His kingdom. His ways are good. He is a good God.